My next guest asks a great question. He asks, why do we pay so much for healthcare in the United States and get so little in return? His name is Marshall Allen, and he is an award-winning reporter for ProPublica, which is an independent nonprofit newsroom that produces investigative journalism. And I was particularly attracted to what his writings with a particular article. It was entitled, Health Insurers Are Vacuuming Up Details About You, and It Could Raise Your Rates. Hey, Marshall, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me here.
So without any public scrutiny, insurers and data brokers are predicting our health costs based upon data about us, social media data and other things. They're looking at our race, our marital status, how much TV we watch, and whether we pay our bills on time, or even if we buy plus-size clothing. Is this something brand new? Have they been doing this for years, but it's been accelerated by the growth of algorithms and big data?
Well, they've definitely been building profiles on us for years, and they've been trying to predict our costs for years. I mean, that's kind of what they're in the business of doing. You know, they want to make sure they can bring in enough money to cover any potential costs, and they want to make sure that they understand any risk that any of us pose. I think what's different about this story and what's new here is that they're working with data brokers to gather a lot of non-health information about us and then make inferences about our healthcare costs. And then possibly, I mean, I wasn't able to determine if it's happening yet, but possibly that information could be used to raise our rates and what we pay, or it could be used to discriminate against patients, or it could be used to structure plans in ways that could pass costs on to patients.
Well, let's think about this. So who are these data brokers? You know, there's a business for everything. If you see a niche and you can fill it, what kind of companies have this data and are able then to package it and sell it to insurers?
Well, so the biggest one that I featured in my story is LexisNexis. And LexisNexis is very well known for the research they do, legal research. I mean, we use their research here as investigative reporters. Mm-hmm. You know, they gather information from public records. And so it could be gathered from lawsuits, from land records, from financial records, credit scores, liens, your race, your education level, the amount of crime that's in your neighborhood. They said that they have more than 400 variables that they have used to correlate to someone's healthcare costs. And then they put together risk scores for healthcare costs based on this non-health information.
Yeah.
And so that's information that they're then marketing to the health insurance industry to help predict the cost of patients.
You know, when I think of big data, I don't think of someone's name and life being associated with it as an identity. I see it as just kind of a sea or an ocean of data that comes together mathematically to derive at certain conclusions. Is this different?
Well, yeah, it's very personal, actually. I mean, you know, this has been done for a long time in the marketing and sales world, right? And we all sense that when we're searching for something on Google and then we start seeing ads pop up for it, you know, to try and sell us based on our search habits. So we all know that we're being tracked more and more, and it is incredibly personal. So they're building individual profiles for us. Another company I featured is called Optum. Optum is owned by United Healthcare, which is the largest health insurance company in the country and one of the largest companies in the country. Mm-hmm. Optum said they are building profiles on hundreds of millions of individual Americans, and they recently filed for a patent that would gather people's social media posts, so Facebook posts or Twitter posts, other things we put on social media. They have text mining programs, and they would then somehow, they didn't say exactly how, but they would somehow use this to link to our healthcare costs.
Yeah. So, I mean, that sounds incredibly disturbing. Some of the things I mentioned, they know our TV habits in some way. I guess they know our shopping habits, so they can tell if we're buying plus size clothing. That's kind of understandable. But I don't really understand how they're getting all of this other information. It's not public information, how much TV I watch.
Well, so for instance, with shopping habits, right? So if you use a rewards card for your grocery store, they can take that information and sell it. So they're giving you a discount to buy items so that they can take that data that they're tracking on you and sell it on the back end. I talked to one vendor. I went to a health insurance conference, and really it was more like a tech conference in the vendor hall. But I talked to one vendor who said, you know, they can see if you have an Amazon Prime membership. If you have an Amazon Prime membership, it tells them a lot about the type of purchasing habits and the types of things that you buy. And I think one of the most sort of disturbing aspects of this is the inferences that they're making. And so, for instance, you mentioned the plus size clothing. You know, if you're a woman who's purchased plus size clothing, what they say in their marketing materials is that they would say that you're considered at risk of depression. And, you know, mental health is something that can be expensive. Or if you're low income and a minority, then the data brokers would say you're more likely to live in a dilapidated and dangerous neighborhood.
Yeah.
And that can increase your health risks. Or even think about a woman who's recently changed her name. So she could be newly married, or maybe she is recently divorced. So maybe she's about to get pregnant, you know, if she's a newlywed, or maybe she's stressed out and anxious from the divorce. And so the computer models then would predict that you're going to have higher medical bills.
A few weeks ago, I interviewed Gary Smith. He's a professor of economics at Pomona College, and he wrote a wonderful book called The AI Delusion. And he said that the belief in our artificial intelligence is overblown. He said it used to be with computers, garbage in, garbage out. You've heard that, right?
Yep, I have, yeah.
And now it's garbage in, gospel out. So we're believing this information that's coming out. And there's also, you know, this idea that, you know, correlations of data, you know, don't prove causation. As a matter of fact, there's a wonderful website I always reference on this show. It's called Spurious Correlations. I don't know if you've seen that, but it measures, you know, how many lawyers there are and, you know, how many people cut themselves from peanut butter and jelly.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
Ridiculous, unrelated events that show correlation somehow in this great mass of data.
Well, and I think that's probably the most offensive thing about this practice is that just because a woman purchases plus size clothing does not mean that every woman who falls in that category would be depressed.
Of course.
And so that's exactly why using non-health information is even more troubling than using, you know, health information, which they also get very invasive with health information as well.
Well, doesn't HIPAA govern this, you know, that form that we sign that protects our medical information?
Well, this is not medical information, so it's not governed by HIPAA at all.
Mm-hmm. So is it a question of whether the government has not yet kept up with this changing technology? Because I know in Europe, this is now outlawed, right?
Right. So Europe passed a law that created much more stringent privacy requirements for data. And one expert I talked to about the European law, which I think they call the General Data Protection Law, they have the presumption that your data would be private. So this personal information about you would not be able to be used and then trafficked by data brokers.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the United States, we haven't really had these conversations. And so the presumption is that all this information is public.
Right.
It can be gathered, it can be tracked, it can be monetized, and then it can be traded, you know, by these data brokers. And in this case, I'm looking at how the insurance industry is using it and all the troubling implications there.
Well, let's talk about what drives the insurance industry. You know, you think that they would be very interested in lowering costs for procedures and reducing the amount of surgeries, let's say, or visits to the emergency room. They're kind of acting on our behalf as insurance providers to whom we are paying our premiums. But it actually, from another article that I read that you posted, that's really not their incentive. Their incentive is not to save costs. Tell us a little bit about how insurance companies really get paid.
Well, you know, this is sort of stating the obvious, but their real incentive is to make money, right? And we sort of think, and this is what's been so interesting as I've learned more about the industry, we think because we are their members that they are supposed to be acting on our behalf. But what I've been trying to show through this series of stories is that the industry is actually aligning itself with other industry players with a lot of side deals, a lot of behind the scenes type of contracts and agreements that are not visible to the patient so that they can make more money off of us. And I think one of the first misconceptions is that insurance companies are actually the ones paying our bills. It's actually the patients are the ones who pay the bills. The insurance companies are the middlemen, and what they want to do is pool the risk and try and predict the risk. And once they can hopefully accurately predict the risk, then they know how much to charge all the people who are paying into that pool of risk. And hopefully then they can manage those costs so that the costs don't exceed the amount of money they've brought in. But it's kind of like they just take a cut. They take an administrative fee and a fee for profit off of the total. And they would tell you that their profits are actually relatively modest, like 3 or 4% a year, which is actually relatively true when you look at their financial statements. But the difference is that if they can make that overall pool of money bigger, if the healthcare costs can go up, then their 3 or 4% of relatively modest sounding profit every year can continue to grow every year. And so they do continue to bring in better value for their shareholders because they keep bringing in more money.
All right, so let me kind of summarize what you've said. If this was a true member organization, they would be interested in keeping costs down and keeping premiums at a certain level. Let's say that they were themselves paying the premiums and they were watching out after their own financial interests. They weren't kind of a third-party broker that was just making commission off of doing administrative. They actually had skin in the game. Then they would want to keep their premiums down, and therefore they want to keep their costs down so they could earn the difference between the two. But what I'm understanding now is that that's not how it works. They are really making a percentage of the revenue, so their only interest is in making sure that they are able to price our premium correctly by saying, well, heck, you know, the costs have risen by so-and-so. We didn't care what we paid. So costs have gone up, and that means that there's more revenues coming in, and they'll increase their revenues by pricing it at their cost plus an administration fee. And so with rising revenues at a 3% commission, they will earn more. And so their really only incentive is to increase their revenues, not to decrease their expenses. Did I get that right?
Yes, that's correct. And the Affordable Care Act actually kind of codified this through what's called the medical loss ratio. And that was in the law, it got put in place that they have to spend anywhere from like 80 to 85% of the money they bring in on medical care itself. Mm-hmm. So their administration and profit can only total, say, 15 to 20%. And so the real way they have to make money is by raising the overall amount of revenue that they bring in. And that's why they'll sometimes accept extremely high prices. And so I got into this by writing about the story of Michael Frank, which you mentioned. And Michael Frank went to a hospital in New York City, NYU Langone Hospital, which is one of the marquee named hospitals in New York City, for a hip replacement. And he ended up getting charged about $70,000 for a hip replacement that at other hospitals in New York City would cost anywhere from, say, $20,000 to $30,000. And Michael Frank happens to be an actuary, and he works in the health insurance industry, and so he knows how it works. And he was flabbergasted to see, why are they accepting this extremely high price? Why is Aetna, my insurance company, paying $70,000? He thought it had to be fraud. And so he complained to everyone he could complain to, and the insurance company was happy to pay that amount. They just said, this is the rate that we have agreed to with the hospital. And what patients don't realize is that insurance companies also make money by creating these networks of providers, hospitals and doctors. And so, you know, an insurance company needs a hospital like NYU Langone in their network.
Yeah, it looks good.
And so they're going to pay them more and they're going to accept that. But then the patient ends up bearing the brunt of that cost.
Yeah. It's very, very complicated. There's a lot of themes and devices that are being used to fuel this industry that we have so little control over. And we think things operate a certain way, but in fact, they don't. My guest is Marshall Allen, and he's a reporter for ProPublica. I really recommend that you go up on that site, ProPublica. It's a nonprofit newsroom for investigative journalism. And of course, to hear this or any other interview again. And if you have a question about what we've discussed, write to us. We love to hear from you. And go to our website at stevepomerantz.com to join the conversation. While you're there, sign up for our weekly update for a brief rundown on the important topics that we've covered that week. Go straight into your inbox. That's stevepomerantz.com. Marshall, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me.